You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Jamal Collier. And Jamal, we've got a lot to talk about here on the podcast this week. We're going to start our positional breakdowns. And for the Nationals, we're starting at the catcher spot. So we'll get into that a little bit. Max Scherzer won't be pitching in the World Baseball Classic because of a knuckle injury. But we want to start with bold predictions. Bold predictions between now and the start of spring training, and that time is kind of quickly evaporating, a little over a month before pitchers and catchers report. The Nationals have certainly made some moves already this offseason, but if there was one bold move left to do, what would it be for this Nationals team?
Yeah, you mentioned a lot to talk about, and the kind of thing is it's kind of been for the whole offseason for the Mets. They've been one of the most active teams and involving seemingly every little trade, every little move, and that's kind of checked in on every player. But the one thing that kind of remains was probably their biggest, number one priority kind of heading into the offseason, and that's, of course, to sign a closer. And it's kind of probably one of the biggest questions in all of baseball here remaining throughout the rest of these last couple of weeks before we head to spring training is exactly who's going to pitch that ninth inning for the Nats. I wrote about it on MLB.com. It'll be up on Tuesday about just as far as the Nats are going to do to fill that role. And I think the guy that makes the most sense in my bold prediction is they're going to be the team that signs Greg Holland. He's a guy who, obviously coming off Tommy John surgery, and there are the kind of question marks that's around that. But the Nats are a team who have known to deal with pitchers with Tommy John surgery, know how to kind of handle a guy coming off that. Sean Kelly, of course, has had two Tommy John surgeries in his career. They have him on the roster. Steven Strasburg, obviously, Jordan Zimmermann. They drafted Lucas Giolito, who was having Tommy John. So they just have a lot of experience dealing with those kind of pitchers, and they don't really shy away from guys coming off that injury. And also, they need a guy to pitch the ninth inning. And when you look at just the rate that closers are getting paid or getting traded for, the fact that they gave up so much to get Adam Eaton, I would think that they're a team that's normally obviously hesitant to give up prospects in general anyway, that they may not want to pay another prospect price, another heavy prospect price to acquire a closer right now. I think that's why Holland makes the most sense. He's a guy who can come in, maybe make him compete for the job, come to spring training, see exactly what he has, but come in and do a spot where he, if he performs well and looks close to his old self, he can get that ninth inning job back if he comes to D.C. The Nationals wouldn't have to put a heavy commitment to him. Maybe you have to give him 2 years, but you're not looking at a whole lot of money. You're looking at a guy with a wrist that they're kind of well adept to handle, a guy coming off Tommy John. If they know how to necessarily do a program or whatever it might be, you know the limitations of pitchers coming off that surgery. So my bold prediction with the Nats will be the team to sign Holland here. We still have a couple of weeks out, and so far they've only kind of shown that's some kind of marginal interest. They've obviously kind of checked in on him and had a person kind of at some of his workouts and checked in, but nothing necessarily aggressive just yet. But I would think as we get closer to the report day for spring training, they're going to kind of turn up the interest a little bit and go after Greg Holland.
That move certainly makes a lot of sense. The good thing the Nationals have going for them is that they do have guys in-house that can fill the role if needed. So Greg Holland, we'll call it an experiment for no other word, as far as the injury goes, doesn't work out. We've talked about it. Sean Kelly can maybe step into that role. They have other guys that could do it. But certainly adding a guy with the experience of Holland at the back end of a bullpen would be a great move late in the offseason. All right, bad news for the Nationals as far as pitchers go on Monday is the news that Max Scherzer, stress fracture in his knuckle, won't be throwing in the World Baseball Classic. That's the bad news. I guess the good news, Jamal, is it sounds like he should be good to go as far as long-term and ready to go opening day, and there's not a lot of concerns about this affecting his regular 2017 season.
Yeah, we got a little more clarity on it later last night after the Nats initially announced it. Max Scherzer sent out a statement on his Twitter account where he said he actually started first feeling this finger injury. It was diagnosed as a sprain. This was kind of in late August. So really it was something he pitched through to the whole last month of the season and into the playoffs. You look at his numbers, they certainly weren't affected by it. I think it was 5-0, 3.2 ERA or something around there with still 10.8 strikeouts per nine innings. So if that's what Max Scherzer potentially compromised is like, you just kind of wonder just how just amazing just how much of a talent he is. But yeah, it's a thing that, basically they thought would kind of just get better with rest. And he said it still kind of bothered me. It didn't bother him, he said, pitching in that last month and a half. It wasn't something that was painful. That's why he just kind of pitched through it. But just the fact that it was still kind of lingering, they had another MRI on it done in December, revealed the stress fracture, I should say, in that right ring finger. And you know, just best, again, to not push it and not extend himself in a game in the World Baseball Classic. You know, he was really excited to pitch. We've been reunited with his former manager, Jim Leland, and pitching coach, Jeff Jones, and guys he has a lot of respect for. But, of course, he's got obviously higher commitments to the Nationals and long-term commitments to the Nationals as well. So just the kind of thing where it doesn't make sense to extend him with, you know, the World Baseball Classic would have been about a month after spring training start. About March 10th or so was the first game. He almost certainly would have pitched one of those first couple of games for Team USA. So best to go ahead and keep him out of that tournament and kind of get him ready for the regular season and focus on rehabbing the injury that way. So as far as what limitations or what things as far as it goes for him in spring training, right now there doesn't seem to be any indicator that there's going to be any. You know, they said he'll be a full participant in spring training, and you would kind of expect him to go along his throwing program and everything else as usual. But does, you know, unfortunately for Team USA, that Max will not be able to participate in the World Baseball Classic, because he would have been a huge addition to that team, one of the highest profile players to pitch not only this year, but probably ever in the history of the tournament.
I'm sure Scherzer is real disappointed he can't throw in the World Baseball Classic. The Nationals as a team may be less disappointed, because I know when it comes to pitching, teams aren't thrilled to have their guys throwing extra games early on like that and sometimes being stretched out a little early. So I'm sure they're quite okay with Scherzer bowing out of the World Baseball Classic.
There,
all right, let's go ahead.
There's always that risk about the World Baseball Classic, but the Nats were seemed at least to be pretty weren't very hesitant, I should say, to allow Max to pitch in it, just because, I mean, this is a guy who threw the most innings in the majors last year too, and I kind of was wondering why to kind of put that undue stress and more innings and more burden on this guy. He's got a lot of miles on him anyway. But, I mean, they really trust the way he takes care of himself and expect and know that, you know, he puts a lot of pride into these kind of things. And they seem to be kind of full backing with him to, you know, to go ahead and pitch this World Baseball Classic. And they've got Daniel Murphy playing as well. Oliver Perez is going to pitch for Team Mexico. So, you know, obviously everybody would probably prefer not extra stress for their pitchers. But, you know, it seemed that they had the Scherzer had the Nats' full blessing, I should say. For this, so I think it was definitely something that it for him it just was kind of not worth the risk, and for them not worth the risk. They decided to just kind of, you know, part ways with this tournament, withdraw from the tournament. So
let's switch to the other side of the battery for this Nationals team and look at this pitching situation. Obviously, Wilson Ramos, a huge part of the 2016 Nationals until the injury late in the season, and of course they didn't have him for the postseason, and that was a big deal. He leaves via free agency. They signed Derek Norris to come in. They also have Jose Lobatone, Pedro Severino, Spencer Keboom still there, also on the 40-man roster. But let's start with Norris because he's the guy that's going to be kind of pinpointed to replace in some way what Wilson Ramos brought. He's coming off a tough year at the plate, Jamal. He's never been known as far as a great defensive catcher, but this is a guy who's still in his 20s, who's been an all-star. What are the Nationals hoping to get from Derek Norris, I guess, first offensively?
Yeah, certainly better than what he was last year. I mean, you look at the last year, they obviously had Wilson Ramos, who was terrific, you know, by some measures and by weighted runs created plus. He was the best offensive catcher in the majors. And to replace that with a guy who, to the same measure, was actually the worst offensive catcher in the majors is kind of an odd, just optics kind of thing. When you look at it and say, well, how can, you know, what are you really kind of expected to get here? They definitely don't think that Derek Norris is going to be what Wilson Ramos was in 2016. They also really don't think that he's going to be what Derek Norris was in 2016. You know, he does have some credentials and the pedigree that you saw only a couple of years ago. He was an all-star in 2014. He was a pretty solid player the year after that in 2015. So, you know, they definitely expect he had a lot of kind of bad luck when he did put the ball in play. He struck out. Strikeouts are up in general, and everybody kind of strikes out a lot. But, you know, he struck out, I think, 30% of the time, which was, you know, one of the worst numbers in the majors this year. But when he did put the ball in play, he kind of had bad luck, low batting average on balls in play. His line drive rate was good, but kind of seemed to be running right into out. So they expect that to be a little better and those numbers to normalize a little bit, maybe him to walk a little more. And he's definitely got some power and some things that he can do in that respect. So Do you expect him to be Wilson Ramos? No, definitely not. But they definitely expect him to be a better version of himself. And we can get a guy on a bargain kind of deal. They didn't give up a highly touted prospect or anything for him. Didn't have to pay a whole lot of money. So it's kind of, you know, kind of a bargain here for a guy you're hoping to have a bounce back season and can fill that role with a rebound for himself.
You mentioned the batting average, balls in play, just 238. So that goes a long way. Obviously, that's not a usual number in baseball when you're putting the ball in play. So you would expect that to go up a bit, and obviously some optimism around Derek Norris. How about the backup spot? Because there's a lot of other catchers here on the roster. Jose Lobatone has kind of been a solid, reliable veteran guy for the Nationals. Pedro Severino, the younger guy coming up that looked pretty good in a real small sample size last season when Ramos got injured. So how does that play out behind Norris on this roster?
Yeah, I think they actually feel pretty confident in that. I mean, Lobatone is a guy that they really like, really rave about. You know, his numbers are not great at times. They're really, really small samples. Especially last season, he got hurt, was nicked up a little bit, so he didn't even play a whole lot. But he's a guy who the pitchers love throwing to. They all rave about his skills as a pitch caller, pitch frame rips, all those kind of things that every backup catcher seems to get remarks for. But, you know, they really enjoy him. And he's one of the team people in the clubhouse they really enjoy. So Lobatone's on a guaranteed contract. He's almost for sure going to be the backup unless some kind of injury strikes. But, you know, they feel good about that, and they really like Severino and Kimum as well. And when you look at those young catchers that can potentially provide something if injury happens or if Severino really makes a big stride. He defensively is probably projects to be one of the better defensive catchers in the league. Just kind of maybe not there with his bat just yet. If you see him make big strides with his bat, you'll probably see him at some point anyway in the majors this year, but especially if he kind of starts hitting the ball well down in Triple-A. But, yeah, they do have some good depth at catcher that they like and they enjoy. That if something were to happen or they need to kind of mix things up, they can do. But right now it looks like Lobatone is definitely kind of slotted into that number two spot. And, you know, the other guys are definitely can push him and potentially, you know, get their way into the majors here sooner than later.
Yeah, Severino, the club's 11th ranked prospect on MLBPipeline.com. Kiboom down to 30 right now. His brother now in the organization is the number three prospect. He's a shortstop. So great depth that you don't always see on a major league team as far as the catching position. It seems like really across the board, kind of the thinnest position around Major League Baseball. So for the Nationals to have basically four guys that in a pinch could step up probably to the major league level and catch is an impressive spot to be. There'll be plenty of pressure on Derek Norris to be the guy, but overall it looks like the Nationals are in a good spot. Thank you so much again, Jamal. Great stuff as always. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. We'll go around the rest of the roster spots for this team as we get closer to spring training. We'll do the rest of the infield, the outfield, the bullpen, and the starting rotation between now and pitchers and catchers reporting in mid-February. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with MLB.com Mets reporter Anthony DiComo. And it continues to be a quiet time in the offseason for the New York Mets. Seems like Yoenis Cespedes re-signed with the Mets years ago at this point because it's been so quiet, Anthony. Obviously, still some work to do at some point in the offseason as far as adding some relief and hopefully for the Mets, trading Jay Bruce at some point. But we're going to start to focus on the 2017 roster as it stands right now. As we look ahead to spring training, we'll go position by position over the coming weeks. We're going to start behind the plate with the catchers, which is going to be a key position for this Mets team in 2017. It all starts with Travis d'Arnaud. Obviously a disappointing 2017. He's shown glimpses in the past when he's healthy. How important is a healthy and productive Travis d'Arnaud to the 2017 Mets?
Oh, he's massively important. You look at the roster, you look at the position players who are there. Really, there's two guys who are on the team who stand a reasonable chance to be significantly better in 2017 than they were in 2016. One of them is Michael Conforto out in the outfield, and the other one is Travis d'Arnaud. I mean, you can talk about other spots in the diamond, like third base, obviously. You know, David Wright can be healthy, can be better, but the Mets got production out of that position. They didn't get any production out of the catching position last year. You know, by the end of the year, Rene Rivera was starting more often than not behind the plate. And he's a nice player. He's a nice piece to have on the team. He'll be the backup again this year. But he's not a starting big league catcher. Everyone around the team knows that. Everyone around the game knows that. Travis d'Arnaud is and can be and has shown in the past that he has that capability, certainly offensively, to be an above average, maybe even if things break right, a great catcher. He hasn't been healthy throughout his entire career, major and minor league career. And when healthy, he hasn't been consistently good. You know, last year or 2 years ago, I should say, he was struggling so much that he went down to the minor leagues as a, not a veteran, but as a player who had been around. You know, last year he missed time with a shoulder injury again. He's had elbow troubles. He's had everything under the sun, really, has kept Travis d'Arnaud off the field, and he just hasn't had that consistent time. You know, he's had some issues defensively. He's obviously had some issues offensively. But you look up, and really, we're less than 2 years removed from a productive Travis d'Arnaud. In 2015, he had a really nice season. He showed glimpses of what he can be, even into the playoffs. I believe he hit 3 or 4 home runs, some of them in big games. He had that monster one that hit the batter's eye, the apple, out in center field at Citi Field, if people remember that, in the World Series. So there were some really big, good, nice things that Travis d'Arnaud has done. And, you know, he is still in his 20s here. He's still a young player. Those abilities, I don't think anyone in the front office and the coaching staff, I don't think anyone wants to just sit here and say that those abilities disappeared, that they evaporated, that there's nothing left in there worth saving. To the contrary, the Mets showed a lot of faith in Travis d'Arnaud this winter in that they are sticking with him. They could have gone out, and granted it would have been out of their budget with other things they're trying to do, but they could have gone out and signed a Matt Wieters or a Wilson Ramos and given them the job effectively and said, you know, the Travis d'Arnaud experiment is over. They didn't do that. They're sticking with d'Arnaud. They're doubling down on d'Arnaud in a sense. They hired a bench coach in Glenn Sherlock, who's a catching expert. And the idea there is, you know, let those two work together in spring training on their defense, clear Travis d'Arnaud's mind on the defensive side of things, throwing, footwork, all of that, so that he really has nothing to focus on except for his hitting. And hitting's what's going to matter for Travis d'Arnaud. Hitting's what's going to keep him as the starter, keep him in the big leagues, keep him in the lineup. And if he can do that, I mean, that's just everything for a Mets team that, again, has a lot of familiar faces at a lot of places where they expect to receive the same production as they did last year, but not a lot of spots where they can really say, all right, we expect this guy to be better. Travis d'Arnaud is one of those guys, and the Mets really need him too.
You mentioned basically what was a vote of confidence by not bringing in anyone else behind the plate. What about Travis d'Arnaud late last season as far as his mental state? I mean, you know, you can't get inside a guy's mind, but you talk to these guys all the time, Anthony. Did he seem like the confidence was kind of shot late in 2016? Does he need to rebuild that? Or is he a guy that always has the confidence? It's just a matter of it working out on the field.
I don't think that Travis d'Arnaud's confidence in himself was shot. I don't think most athletes are wired that way. I think in general, you know, baseball players think they're going to succeed all the time. And obviously that's not always the case, but I don't think Travis d'Arnaud ever really doubted himself. What I think he started to doubt was that, am I going to get the opportunities? And he had lost those opportunities. You know, Rene Rivera started the National League wildcard game, and that was because, you know, Noah Syndergaard preferred throwing to him. You know, a lot of these pitchers who have had trouble holding on base runners, Rene Rivera was helping them with that. I think a lot of the pitchers by year's end were just more comfortable with Rivera because of how adept he was defensively, game calling, all of that stuff. So the point is, none of that would have happened for as good of a defensive catcher and as good of a veteran leader as Rene Rivera is. None of that would have happened if Travis d'Arnaud was hitting 280 with 25 home runs at that point. You know, offense plays in this league, especially at that position where you just don't see that many plus offensive players behind the plate. Again, Travis d'Arnaud can be one of those guys. And, you know, I don't think that it was confidence was an issue so much as he was looking up at the end of the year and saying, well, you know, I'm in this spot now where I'm playing one out of every two games, even one out of every three games. Rene Rivera is the starter. I should be the starter. And I think that's the mentality that he has to have going into spring training. I think, you know, he doesn't necessarily need to look at this as I'm competing for a job, but maybe it's not the worst mentality in the world to go into camp and say, look, I have to prove myself all over again. I was once a top prospect. Remember, Travis Darno was the guy in the R.A. Dickey trade. Noah Syndergaard was not the guy. He was a nice live arm that the Mets hoped would turn into something. Travis Darno was the blue chipper in that trade. And, you know, he needs to come back out and almost like he's coming to camp for the first time all over again as that top prospect and say, look, I have to prove that I belong here. I have to prove that, you know, I deserve these at-bats. I deserve these reps behind the plate. And, you know, if he can go and do that with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder in spring training, I don't think the confidence is going to be lacking. I think he believes he can do it, and I think the Mets believe that with the proper coaching, he can.
You mentioned Rivera. Kevin Plawecki also on the 40-man roster as far as catching goes. Rivera, obviously you want him to be the backup. You don't want him to get as much playing time as he did late in 2016. How about his value beyond catching, beyond being a really good defensive catcher? How about the veteran presence in that clubhouse? Because Rivera seems to be a guy that can really give a clubhouse a lift as well, and guys can just really feed off of him.
Yeah, for sure. And what he did last year was tough to do. You know, he was signed with the Mets really at the very end of spring training, and you know, didn't have camp to come and spend all of February, March getting to know people, and then, you know, he was in the minor leagues for a time. So to come in kind of cold mid-season and develop that chemistry both with the pitching staff and with other people on the team, I think it speaks volumes as to what kind of a guy, what kind of a veteran leader Rene Rivera is. And I think that's a big reason why the Mets wind up tendering him a contract this winter. They need that stability back there, especially because, you know, we've just spent 6 or 7 minutes here talking about what we don't know about Travis Darno. Well, at least they have that bedrock to fall back on. At least they have this guy that, again, while he's not an offensive performer, you know, you could stick him in there once a week and he's going to call a good game. He's going to help defensively and so on and so forth. So that's really nice to have. You know, the Mets went into last year thinking, we don't know if Travis Darno can stay healthy. We don't know what he's going to provide us. But at least we have this really intriguing guy in Kevin Plawecki who we can fall back on if Travis Darno gets hurt. That hasn't worked out for the Mets for a couple of years now. Every time Darno has gotten hurt and Kevin Plawecki has stepped in, Plawecki just has not performed up to his expectations, up to the Mets' expectations. So he's kind of run out of rope a little bit, and you'll see him at AAA. And I think that's just why it's, again, ultra important for the Mets to have Rene Rivera back there. The pitchers clearly all like throwing to him. He calls a good game. And, you know, the other aspect that gets talked about a lot, which I mentioned earlier, is the holding base runners. You know, Noah Syndergaard allowed so many stolen bases last year. Even Steven Matz, a left-hander, allowed so many stolen bases last year. As a staff, the Mets are not good at holding base runners. And, you know, while Rene Rivera isn't the best in the game at throwing out base stealers and arm strength and all of that, he's average to above average in all of those areas. And it makes a huge difference from someone like Travis Darno, who was significantly below average last year. You saw it in games. You saw, you know, kind of Rene Rivera, the Mets had a chance when he was back there behind the plate. And I think that's a nice thing for them to have. I think certainly it's something that Travis Darno can watch and learn a little bit, you know, from Rivera as much as he can from Glenn Sherlock, the bench coach, the catching coordinator. So all of these are aspects, all of these are important aspects. And yeah, I think the Mets are really pleased with what Rene Rivera gave them in a small sample last year.
Certainly going to be interesting monitoring the catcher position throughout 2017, because like you said, it's a spot where improvements can be had and where this Mets team can get better. But Darno, Rivera, I guess if an injury happens, Kevin Plawecki will be back up in the big leagues as well. You look at that group and there's promise. It's just a matter of whether or not it works out and it comes through. But it's good to have Rivera as I think you put it, a rock. It's good to have that there as a backup plan to Travis Darno. Spring training will tell us a lot with Glenn Sherlock there working with Darno. It'll be interesting. All right, so that's your catching you up on the catchers for the New York Mets, but we'll work our way through the roster as we get closer and closer to spring training here on the podcast. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DeComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Marlins reporter, Joe Fusaro. Joe, it's time to start breaking down this Marlins roster as we get closer and closer to spring training. A little over a month to go until pitchers and catchers report. We'll take that month by going around the diamond, basically, and focusing in on each position. We're going to kick things off with the starting rotation, and it's certainly an interesting starting rotation. There is depth there. The question mark is what comes at the top of that rotation, I guess. And And maybe the biggest question is who's going to start opening day. That'll probably work itself out in spring training. But let's get right into it as far as this starting rotation goes. Let's start with the new additions, because obviously they bring in Edinson Volquez and Jeff Locke to try to help out this team. Obviously, there's a big hole there after the tragic passing of Jose Fernandez, and that was something this team needed to do in the offseason. Let's start with Volquez. It's a veteran presence. It's a guy that's been around. He's pitched in big games. Wasn't exactly lights out by any means last year. Struggled at times. What is the Marlins' viewpoint of Volquez and how he fits into this starting rotation?
Yeah, Tim, he probably will be the most significant offseason addition the Marlins made. If you look at the dollar spent, what, 2 years, $22 million, a lot of we've talked about, kind of building up the bullpen. But Volquez has kind of been asked to come in here and replace the innings, not the talent of Jose Fernandez. Let's make that very clear. That this is a guy, this is an organization right now looking for innings and hopefully, for their point of view, quality innings from a starter. And Edison had over 189 last year, and Jose, remember, was on that innings limit. He finished the year like at 182 and a third. So Volquez is very significant in bringing him in to be a stabilizing presence in the rotation. A guy potentially could be the opening day starter, has won a World Series with Kansas City, and a guy, as breaking it down, he made 34 starts last year for the Royals. 21 of those, Tim, were 6 innings or more and 5 7-innings or more. So they want him to go deep in the games and quite simply just keep the team in the game. And they think that, you know, the fact that he's been durable through his career, one of the focal points of this offseason wasn't to take a risk on and go high on a guy like a Rich Hill who has a history of injury, and obviously the talent and stuff is you know, elite, but the dependability wasn't always there. They rather get more of a sure bet, and that's why they targeted a guy like Volquez.
Yeah, so in Volquez, it's the addition where you kind of know what you're getting, or at least you hope you do. Jeff Locke is kind of a different story. He's a guy that at times in his career has really looked great, has some good stuff, but has never really been able to put together a full season in his time in Pittsburgh. Now he comes over to the Marlins. Obviously, the goal is to see more of good Jeff Locke and less of bad Jeff Locke, but how does that happen?
Well, here's probably a very low-risk, high-reward type of deal. 1 year, $3 million, so not a ton invested there with the potential of sliding into the bullpen if they were to, you know, get another starter along the way. Now, Tim, keep this in mind. With Jeff Locke, there's history with Jim Benedict, the Marlins' vice president of pitching development, who was previously in the Pirates organization. So Benedict has his fingerprints on all pitching moves, is the most influential man in the organization when it comes to deciding which pitchers to pursue, and they're buying into his program on how to pitch. So obviously they're looking for a turnaround and a hope that in Jeff Locke, who is left-handed and joins this rotation, will offer, you know, something that Benedict sees. I don't know exactly what that is. We got to kind of get to camp and see what they work on. But this is almost like a Jim Benedict project and hope that Jeff Locke, can go out there and, you know, keep his team in the game and, you know, pitch obviously changing speeds and just kind of be reliable enough to go out there and carry at least the midway point of the game.
So there's your new additions to this rotation. Let's get to the returners now. And there's some young guys, obviously, and veterans as well. Let's start with Adam Conley, because plenty of upside still for Conley. He was pretty good in 2016. He helped fill out that rotation. He made 25 starts for this team. The ERA was pretty good. How much more is now going to be kind of thrown on Adam Conley, or how much more pressure is on Adam Conley in 2017?
Well, Tim, without question, there's a lot. But I think what Adam has to guard against is trying to think he's got to step up and replace Jose in terms of being the guy who has got the ace stuff. And Adam may tend to do that because he's highly competitive and passionate. Now, if Adam stays within himself and does what he can, he really showed some promise. He was kind of their pitching star in spring training last year, and kind of the guy that was almost a differentiator and took this team, you know, into the postseason, which for 4 months they looked like they were trending that way. Then Adam also got hurt in August. Now his injury was finger, so it's nothing alarming in terms of anything arm. So that's really encouraging. He made 25 starts, and you know, this is a kid who flirted with a no-hitter late in April, I believe it was, up in Milwaukee. So there's a lot of upside. His slider is really good. He really pitches with his fastball also. And I just think this guy, he could, on his best days, he's probably a two, but I think if you want to play it safe, he probably settles more as a three. And if he can pitch more like a two, I think the Marlins, you know, will have a guy who, at least stuff-wise, is the best that they have.
Then you have Wei-Yin Chen, who obviously was an addition a year ago and a free agent guy and a guy that couldn't get through 2016 fully healthy. Do they like what they'll get from him if he's healthy? Is that the biggest question mark with Wei-Yin Chen? Or at his age, are there also some concerns that the stuff is regressing?
No, I think it's fair to say he might be the key to the whole season. You know, this guy, many forgot he was the opening day starter last year, but that was because of how they were using Jose with their innings plan. And, you know, he was obviously, an $80 million investment, too. And a history of durability in Baltimore, who pitched to a pretty low ERA in the American League East. So, his numbers all kind of were skewed in the eyes of the Marlins because this guy had tremendous success in the division that it's hard to have success in, especially in those ballparks up in the AL East. And he came down here, and it just never clicked for him. On opening day, he got hit by a comebacker on his elbow, and, you know, he missed time. He missed, like, 2 months in the Marlins. The last thing they thought that guy wasn't going to give him 30 starts. But, you know, this is one reason why this organization has always traditionally been really, really hesitant to spend on starting pitching in the free agent market is durability. And the guy that seemed a safe bet as any to go 880 to 200 innings ends up making, 22 starts, and really the starts in the final – you know, a couple of starts at the end of the season were just more easing them back and just kind of getting them, you know, back with the mound. There is got to be some concern about the arm. I mean, there was like a forearm elbow type issue, and he had Tommy John surgery many years ago. And, you know, maybe there's something there that they got to be, you know, a little concerned with. But if he can, you know, be healthy, this kid, you know, this guy knows how to pitch, and they're going to really be counting on him to not only log a lot of innings, but win a lot of games. And that, and he possibly, I think, either Chen or Volquez may get the nod for opening day.
So when you look at that fifth starter spot, Tom Kohler obviously made a lot of starts in 2017. The question, I guess, for you, Joe, is he the guy? Is there a competition there? Because Jose Urena's in the mix. Justin Nicolino, obviously, still a prospect who struggled at times, did make 18 appearances, 13 starts a year ago. So I guess technically not a prospect anymore. But what is the deal with the fifth starter role at this point as we head into spring training? Is it Kohler's to lose? Is it an open competition?
No, I think Tom is pretty safe. I mean, he's a guy at 33 starts last year. He's been the guy that, you know, even if he doesn't have the greatest of spring trainings, they're not going to say, oh, well, let's, you know, start him off in the bullpen or whatever. You know, this is a guy who's made, you know, 30-plus starts a few years in a row now, and has been, you know, probably the most durable pitcher they've had probably since, 14 or 15. And, you know, I think Tom is going to pitch. He may pitch in the fourth spot. You know, Locke may get the fifth. I mean, keep in mind, there are three lefties here, which is kind of unique in its own right. So I kind of would, if I were lining them up, I might have TK in the four hole and Locke in the fifth. So that's how I kind of think they're going to do it. You know, Tom is highly competitive, and there are outings he has that are just really sensational, and then others not so good. And I think, you know, a lot with him is command, obviously, with a lot of pitchers, but Tom especially. His breaking ball is really effective. He gets a lot of swing and misses on it. So I think that they're going to probably just kind of look at him analytically and say which have been his best pitches and try to, you know, do the best to maximize, you know, how they're, you know, how he's mixing them in and you know, calling a game and pitching a game. So I think Tom is the one guy that also, I think you can kind of put him there when you noted Volquez earlier about you kind of know what you're getting. And Tom will win you about 10 games. And, you know, I think that, you know, if he gets in the hot streak, you know, he could give him you know, a stretch of being, you know, a really high-end type of guy. So Tom is the, again, going around in circles a bit, but he's a guy that who's kind of been a bulldog and for this franchise. He's homegrown, and I kind of anticipate more of the same in 17.
No team gets through the season with five starters. I mean, that's fairly safe to say. And the good thing for the Marlins when you look at it is they have guys who have experienced a little bit over the last year or two to plug in, and those are the guys I mentioned, Jose Urena, Justin Nicolino. Anyone else coming up through that could be a factor in that rotation?
Yeah, Luis Castillo. I think we got him a 4 or 5 on the prospect, whatever the latest pipeline prospect list has him. A right-hander will probably open the season in AAA. Castillo is a guy who's touching 97, right-hander, who I've talked to scouts in other organizations and think this guy potentially could be a 2. He, you know, may settle as a 3 or 4 or even 5 until you actually prove yourself. But he's the guy that – interesting story because people who hear the name, and it's not to be confused with Luis Castillo, the former second baseman, he was traded as part of the deal to go to the Padres. And, you know, when Colin Ray and Andrew Cashner came to Miami, well, Ray had the arm issue – and after making just one start in Miami, got sent back, and they kind of redid that part of it and returned, you know, Castillo back to the Marlins, and that might end up being a blessing for the Marlins because he right now, in terms of starter ready, is probably, you know, the one guy internally that could give them a little bit of spark and you know, maybe pick up the slack if somebody doesn't, you know, perform the way they want or there's injury. But he's also a guy, I think, you know, with service time, we could be looking at a June, you know, a June type of call-up. They have a left-hander named Dylan Peters, who also is in a similar situation to Castillo in terms of being close to being big league ready. So you got those two, who I think, and, you know, as we look at the minor leagues, and then you got, as you noted, Nicolino will probably open the year in AAA. Nicolino may end up in the bullpen at some point, but I think they're going to see. Apparently, he's gotten a little bigger. They're trying to get, you know, a little stronger, maybe get a little more velocity. And, you know, that's the guy they have options. And Jose Urena, who you mentioned earlier, is out of options. He's got to make this team. So if he doesn't, that guy could be traded. So I think that they might be looking at Urena as a guy that could kind of float in there and be a long reliever, make the club, and then see if something happens in the rotation that you know, moves them up there. You know, they don't have a ton of power right-handed arms, and Urena is probably it right now for them. So they're going to need Urena to kind of reach that next level in terms of consistency, because if you look at the numbers, what was it, like 4-9 with a 6 ERA in the big leagues last year, going, you know, I think 12 starts and the number of relief appearances. So the stuff is there. The command hasn't always been, and they're going to need him to kind of kick it in the gear. If not, I wouldn't be shocked if he's traded before opening day.
If the Marlins are going to contend and compete in 2017, they're going to have to get some lifts from these starters. That's certainly a fact as we head towards spring training. So that is the breakdown of the starting rotation. We'll work our way around the roster as we get closer to spring training. Great stuff as always, Joe. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Frisaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Braves reporter, Mark Bowman. And, Mark, we're going to start our positional breakdowns this week. We'll do a different position each week leading up to spring training, which is little over a month away. Hard to believe, but it's coming fast, and Braves fans, and maybe head down to Florida, get ready for spring training. But beyond that, we'll talk about catchers today, but let's do some other newsworthy stuff before we get to that, Mark, and start with Freddie Freeman. Sounds like he's going to play for Canada in the World Baseball Classic. Surprised at all?
Not really. I mean, you know, maybe the only surprise was that, you know, if Votto was going to play, you thought, well, Freeman's not going to go there just to provide some assistance here and there. He wants to be, you know, wants to play on a consistent basis if you're leaving spring training. So, you know, once Votto made it clear that he was not going to play, I think this was the expectation that Freeman would go ahead and play for Canada. He's you know, it's where his maternal grandparents, his mother's from there. His mother's always obviously held a special place in his heart and his career, just from the fact, you know, she passed away at when he was, I believe, 9 years old from melanoma. And he's just, you know, there's just everything he does he's never forgotten her memories. Talks about the times where there was a light pole out in right center field at the little park that his dad used to throw in BP to, and his mother at that time was, you know, I believe when she was in remission, she was out walking the dog, and the first time he hit that light pole that he'd always been aiming for, she was standing right underneath it. And he wears the sleeves there in her memory. You know, just to do something in her honor, I can see that. I can see why he wants to go ahead and play in this event and represent her country.
Yeah, and that's a great backstory behind some of the reasoning for Freddie Freeman playing for Canada. Good stuff. Brandon Phillips, reports came out, Mark, that he blocked a trade to the Braves. He did a similar thing last year, possible trade from the Reds. It seems like he just wants to play things out in Cincinnati. But it sounds like it wasn't that he was completely against going to the Braves as much as the Reds couldn't quite kind of check all the boxes that he needed to take place in order to allow it to happen. They've said maybe the door's not closed. Do you see any situation where this could be revisited and Phillips could end up being a Brave?
I mean, I think from the Reds' end, you know, obviously they got to a point to where the process where they had to ask for his permission, they went that far down the road. They're hoping that the door's still open from the Braves' perspective. I don't see any reason for the door to still be open because they after this occurred, I went ahead and signed Sean Rodriguez, who I see playing second base on getting most of the reps there until Albies is ready. Ozzie Albies is ready at some point this year, maybe next year. Whatever the case, I do believe that they are in a better spot with Rodriguez unless they were getting, you know, and this is what the expectation was, that they certainly weren't going to be paying much of Phillips' contract. It was just going to be a destination place or a place for the Reds to send him for the Braves to give up. Or, you know, it wasn't the expectation, wasn't a top 10 prospect per se. It was something that made sense for the Braves at the time. I think that they since see that Sean Rodriguez is a better fit. And, you know, while the Reds may hope that door is still open, I don't think the Braves view it that way.
The Braves pull off a trade on Wednesday, Mark, as well. They send away a couple of young players, get some young talent in return. Malik Smith, really probably the name that sticks out as far as players going to Seattle, and he actually eventually ended up in Tampa Bay as Seattle swung another trade. But let's talk about who the Braves are getting in this deal. Luis Gohara and Thomas Burrows. How do these guys fit into the Braves system organization right now?
You know, both these guys are going to be at the lower levels, but this is another instance where the Braves basically cleared some excess off their 40-man roster, a couple guys that didn't factor into their immediate plans. They went and tried to enrich their farm system with two power arms, especially Gohara. To look at Gohara was ranked fifth in the Mariner system by MLBPipeline.com. You know, I don't know exactly where he's going to fit within Atlanta's system. My guess is somewhere there between 10 and 15. A good-looking 20-year-old prospect who's touched fastballs touched near 100. But I think the intriguing thing is not only is he a hard thrower, but his secondary stuff has developed enough to the point where he at least keep open the hope that he could develop into a starter. Burrows. I see both these guys either starting at Class A Rome or down there with the new team in Florida, the Class A Advanced team. The Burrows probably could come a little bit faster just because he had some collegiate experience there at the University of Alabama as their closer. He's a little bit older. And, you know, once he gets his feet under him this year, starts his first full professional season, I could see him rising quickly, especially if he lives up to the Braves' expectations. But the centerpiece of this deal was Gohara. Like I said, it's a good-looking left-hander that's from Brazil. We certainly don't talk about prospects from Brazil too often, but he's had some hiccups here during his early years, but he's just 20. To go ahead and take a couple guys like Malik Smith and Shea Simmons, who didn't fit into this year's plans and probably not beyond if some of their other prospects continue to develop like they expect. The Braves just simply tried to add a few more arms to a system that is very rich in
pitching right now.
All right, let's get into the backstop position for this Atlanta Braves team heading into 2017, Mark. And I know late in the 2016 season, there was a lot of talk about, oh, maybe it's a great time to bring back Brian McCann, trade for him, because there's an availability there to upgrade the catcher position. And then there was even talk maybe the Braves would get involved in Matt Wieters as far as free agency goes. In the end, at this point, well, Matt Wieters is still available, but it seems like the Braves kind of have their guys. And just let's start with how it all plays out. They did add a catcher in Tuffy Goswitch, claiming him off waivers from the D-backs. But if the season started tomorrow, is Tyler Flowers going to be a guy that how many games does he play, I guess, is the question, behind the plate for the Braves in 2017?
Yeah, I think the expectation would be that Flowers catches that right there in between that 100 to 110, makes 110 starts behind the plate there. Whether Wrecker takes up, you know, each of those other games, or like you said, they added Goswitch. I don't think that they're going to go outside. If they were going to go outside the organization and make a significant move, especially on the free agent market, it would have been with Wilson Ramos. You know, and obviously Ramos' injury there the final week of the season halted that pursuit, their potential pursuit. You know, even as they went through the early portion of this offseason, you know, I was still hearing that, you know, well, what if Ramos is willing to take one year and $5 million? That really wasn't feasible, because you look at that and he's probably not going to be able to play until June. What are you paying for there? I mean, it made sense for him to go to an American League team. The Rays deal made a lot more sense for him. This brings us back to Wieters. While you may hear something that, you know, you'll continue to hear, oh, the Braves are still keeping their ears open on Wieters. Look, if Matt Wieters gets to that point where he's willing to sign 1 year and $8 million, something like that, the Braves might be in play. But I don't see Scott Boras allowing that to happen. I don't think Matt Wieters wants that to happen. But you know, maybe if we get to that point, then the plans would be changed. But as they move forward, I think you're going to look at Tyler Flowers and Anthony Wrecker beginning of the season there as their catchers. As you move forward, this is an area where they do have to address at some point within the next year. With Flowers, they're going to be a free agent after this year. This is the one area of their farm system that they're not well-stocked. They've even got Alex Jackson, the Mariners prospect that they acquired back in December. They've got him. He'll be doing some work behind the plate for the first time in maybe 3 years now. They're going to see, you know, he was a high school catcher, you know, see if he can do some work behind the plate. This is all an attempt to fill an area of need within, what is an otherwise pretty rich pipeline. But at the catcher's position, there really isn't a lot to look forward to. So they have to look at the next few years. You know, obviously Alex Jackson is not going to be available next year. So within the next few months, or, you know, next 12 months at least, you and I are going to have more conversations about what will they do at catcher. But from the immediate plans, you know, look for Flowers and Wrecker to begin the season as their catchers.
You kind of know what you're getting with those two guys as far as production and what they can do behind the plate. But how about dealing with young pitching? Because obviously the Braves are going to have more and more of this young pitching coming up through the system. A lot of it was up last year. There'll be more to come. Is Tyler Flowers a guy that they like, just being a guy that these pitchers can lean on and depend on as their guy behind the plate?
I think Tyler Flowers is a great guy to talk to. I think that he works very hard on his defense. You can look at his caught stealing numbers last year and talk about, near historically bad. That's obviously an area of concern, but at the same time, if you believe in pitch framing, he checks off that box really well. He's one of the better, in terms of metrics, he rates there really high the last couple of years. He truly is a guy who takes the pitchers do like communicating with it. He's easy to talk to. He knows what he's doing. He's learned the craft really well. I do think that they do have some trust in him being a guy that these young kids can be comfortable with. Like I said, you can look at the caught stealing numbers last year and have, you know, definite reasons for concern. But at the same time, here's a guy who's going to be able to call a good game and talk to these pitchers, provide the comfort that they need. And you know, from most aspects behind the plate, he's certainly above average.
So that's your situation behind the plate as far as the Atlanta Braves go heading into 2017, barring any big story, I guess, over the next month or so. We'll break down each position as we go along, Mark, between now and pitchers and catchers reporting from the outfield to the infield, starters and relievers. Great stuff as always. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. For Mark Bowman, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Phillies reporter Todd Zalecki. A little over a month to go before pitchers and catchers report. So Todd, on the podcast over this next month, we're going to go in depth kind of on each position, breaking down each position around the horn, bullpen, starting rotation for this Phillies team to get people ready for spring training. And we're starting things off with the young rotation, and maybe not as young as we thought it would be because of an offseason addition, but overall we'll work our way through it here on the podcast. I want to start with the veterans, then we'll get on to the young guys and the question marks as far as this rotation goes. But when you talk about veterans, obviously Jeremy Hellickson accepts the qualifying offer, so he's back, and then they go out and they trade for Clay Buchholz. So there's two guys who have been around the major leagues, know what it's all about. How important are they, not just what they can give this team on the mound, but how important is it for both of them to really be able to embrace the younger guys? I know Hellickson did that last year, and just help bring these young guys along and help this rotation as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's an important part of this. You know, while the Phillies were prepared for Hellickson to reject the qualifying offer, and they weren't necessarily planning from day one of the offseason, like, we have to go out and get Clay Buchholz, they appreciate the veteran presence that they bring and Hellickson, and not necessarily even in a day-to-day, I'm going to mentor you, talk to you, pull you aside every day type of thing, but just having a couple of veterans in there, I think it's kind of almost a calming influence, and knowing as well that when they're healthy, they can pitch 180, 200 innings and give the rest of the rotation maybe a little bit less pressure to go out there and pitch 6-7 innings. I think that goes a long way for a young team that's trying to develop some starting pitching. So, you know, it's almost kind of like a little bit of a trickle-down effect. They're hoping that, you know, if Hellickson's the opening day starter and Buchholz starts game two or three, that they can kind of provide, you know, a little bit more leeway, I guess, if some other guys struggle, if there's injuries, and just give their organization a little bit more depth. And then, you know, big picture-wise, certainly they're hoping that both of them pitch well and everything breaks right. Maybe the Phillies find themselves unexpectedly in the wild card hunt come July. But if they pitch well and they're not in the wild card hunt come July, then they become potentially pretty attractive trade pieces.
Yeah, and that's kind of the other level to having those two guys, is they weren't able to trade Hellickson last trade deadline. Then he accepts the qualifying offer, so they don't get the first-round pick for him. But then one more chance maybe coming up this July to deal Hellickson and get something in return, especially because with the new CBA, those qualifying offers aren't quite what they used to be as far as compensation goes for the team. So that'll be certainly something to keep an eye on come July, and we'll see what they can give the Phillies before that. Now, after Hellickson and Buchholz, there's a couple of guys that I think we can classify them as younger guys who are going to be locks in this rotation. Jared Eichhoff, Vincent Velasquez. Velasquez, at times last year, was absolutely tremendous. And Eichhoff good and showed stuff as well. Let's start with Velasquez. What do the Phillies expect from him this year? Do they expect him to be like a number two starter, number three starter on this team?
Yeah, I think long-term they certainly do, and possibly as early as next season they do. You mentioned like he had some really great stretches, and he did, and then like any young pitcher, he also had his struggles. I think a couple times last season Vince got maybe fell in love from game to game with a particular pitch. Some games he would just seem to go hard, and he would get hit hard, and he wouldn't necessarily change up his repertoire during the game. Sometimes he would fall in love with his off-speed stuff, and, you know, he would get hit hard that way. So I think last season was a really good learning experience for him. It seemed to me like he kind of, you could kind of hear a difference in his opinion of his pitching as the season went on, particularly late in the season. He understands that, you know, if I want to be great, I need to kind of work on some things. I just can't do everything my way. You know, A.J. Ellis was with the team the last month or so of the season, and I think he had a real good influence on Vince. He gave Vince kind of an off-season
homework assignment of studying Zach Greinke video because Vince said, you know, he kind of likes the way, kind of thinks he has a similar style as Zach Greinke back when he was dominating with the Dodgers. And so AJ said, all right, well, I want you to go and spend the next several weeks of the season and the off season and watch Zach Greinke pitch and see what makes him effective. So I'm looking forward to talking to Vince in spring training about, you know, did you do this? What do you think you're going to learn from it? So if he puts all those pieces together and he can stay healthy, health is always a concern for Vince. But he certainly has the pitching repertoire to be a dominant pitcher. You know, it's just a matter of him kind of figuring things out and then moving forward with it.
And then Eichhoff, is he a lock to start the season in this rotation?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny, when there was some concern, but then when there were some questions about Hellickson, you know, is he going to come back, is he not going to come back? I remember late last season we were asking Jared, do you think you're going to be the opening day starter? I mean, he really pitched that well. His record wasn't that great, but as we know in today's day and age, starting pitcher can only have so much effect on wins. The Phillies had really terrible run support throughout the season. He pitched really well. Couple games in Atlanta, I think, got rained out. He got pulled up from a game real early because of rain, but if not, he would have been close to 200 innings. He really is a workhorse. They love his mentality. The defenders love playing behind him because he works fast. I have not heard anybody ever say anything bad about Jared Eichhoff as a pitcher, as a person. You know, like I said, the way he works on the mound, everybody seems to really love this guy. And while he might not be the next, he's not Max Scherzer, right? But, you know, every rotation needs that solid number three guy, number two, number three, number four guy, whatever, however he's going to end up slotting in. A guy that can go out and give you 190, 200 innings every year with an ERA, you know, around 3, 3.5. And the Phillies think they got that for sure in Jared Eichhoff.
Now, if we had had this discussion, Todd, last April or May, we would have locked in Aaron Nola, obviously, as a starter in this rotation. The second half of the year really went downhill quickly and kind of blew up, for lack of another word. He ended up 6-9, a 4.78 ERA, but he had the low-grade ligament tendon strain in the arm, which is another concern. So let's attack him from two angles. Are the Phillies concerned about the arm and whether or not he'll be ready to go at the beginning of the season? And then B, how much of his struggles was because of that? Is there still confidence that he can be a towards the top of the rotation starter eventually?
Yeah, so one, he went down, he rested, they gave him those PRP injections in July, and they basically shut him down completely. He went down to extended spring instructional league in Clearwater, Florida, late in the year, and he threw. And everybody I've talked to said that he threw great, and they think the injury is behind him. You know, but that's instructional league, that's fall, that's only throwing for a few weeks. But they, like I said, everybody has told me that they think he is fine. They sent him home, went home to Louisiana for the winter. They said he is totally good to go. There should not be any restrictions on him. So that remains to be seen. You know, I've every pitcher on every, you know, a lot of pitchers and throughout baseball have gone in the off season, coming back from injuries, quote unquote healthy. Then, you know, 3 weeks into spring training, there's a little bit of problem with the elbow again. So that remains to be seen. Now, how much did it affect him? It's interesting because even after the injury got diagnosed, finished the season on the disabled list, Aaron still maintained that he didn't think it bothered him that much. I kind of personally disagree with that. I got to think that there's a reason why he went from being, you know, I think we talked about this early last season, like potential all-star candidates. He was definitely aligned to be an all-star candidate for the Phillies. I mean, there's no doubt about it. His ERA was in the mid-2s. His numbers were stacking up with everybody. And then all of a sudden, he falls off the face of the earth and he's getting an ERA of over 5 or 6 for like a, you know, series of several starts. So I have to think that the injury caused that. He just didn't forget how to pitch or just, you know, got gun-shy or teams figured him out or whatever. So I got to think if he's healthy and he returns to form, that he's practically a lock for this rotation. But again, that all that remains to be seen on how his health goes in spring training.
So, like you said, those are ideally your five starters, Hellickson, right? Buchholz, Velasquez, Eichhoff, and Nola. But there's so much depth now as far as young pitching that there's Jake Thompson, there's Alec Asher, there's Zach Eflin, there's other guys. So when you look at all those guys, I'm not going to go through every one of them because who knows when they'll pitch in the big leagues or whether they're not. But of that other group of young starters that may eventually be a part of this rotation for the Phillies, who's kind of first on the list? If something goes wrong with those other five, who's the first guy we'll see?
Well, in terms of first guys on the list, I think there's really, quite honestly, three pitchers you could choose from. It's Jake Thompson, Zach Eflin, and Alec Asher. And then, you know, there's like four guys behind them, Ben Lively, Nick Pivetta, Mark Appel, and Adam Morgan. But Thompson, Eflin, and Asher, I guess if I had to handicap it right now going into the season, I'd have Alec Asher as the, I guess, the number six starter because he performed well late in the season. He missed most of the year with a steroid suspension, PED suspension. But when he joined the Phillies in September, he did throw the ball really, really well. Now, Thompson and Eflin were both kind of up and down when they got their opportunities. Thompson started off really poorly, but then he kind of figured something out in his last few starts and really pitched well. And Eflin, he had a really bad start in his big league debut, pitched really well, and then struggled. But they, you know, the belief there is his knee injuries caused him to struggle in his last few starts of the season. So just going on by consistent body of work, I guess you'd have to make Asher the favorite to be the number six guy should something happen to those first five guys or should Nola not be ready. But after him, I think it's Thompson and Eflin, and I really don't think that they're too far apart or too far behind Asher.
And that depth is certainly a positive for this Phillies team, whether or not these guys all end up pitching for the Phillies or when they get to the point where they're competitive again and contending, maybe some of these guys can be trade chips as well. But certainly plenty of names to watch heading into 2017. And what's going to be an interesting kind of rotation to monitor throughout the year for all sorts of different reasons. We even mentioned the trade deadline type chips that are in there as well. So that's it for the starting rotation as far as the Phillies go heading into 2017. We'll take a look at a different part of this roster each week between now and pitchers and catchers reporting. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition. For Todd Zalecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go every night on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.